Okay, we are we're still on Psalm 5. Pardon?
Are we going to start over?
Well, I'm going to review again, just briefly, like I do. And then we do always start over at the psalm that I'm on. So that's why you always have to pray that I'm going to get through the psalm before the end of the session, or else we're going to have to review every bit of it the next day. So, I mean, we're going to always have that. We're on Psalm 5, and I had the opportunity to preach Psalm 1 again this past Sunday in Starkville. So I had a chance to, country church and a church in Starkville, two different places. And I was able to share with them something that that I thought would probably be good for our group here too as well, is that the Psalms, if you remember, were the experiences of the ordinary Jewish person. Most of them King David. Sometimes when he was a king, sometimes when he was supposed to be a king, was being chased by Saul to be killed. You know, all these different things in his life. Sometimes, bad situations, sometimes a good situation. Some about other people, one's by Moses, one's by Solomon. You know, it's various and sundry people, but there, a lot of them are just common folk where we don't know what the titles want. But they're the heart, under inspiration, basically, they represent the life of a person walking, trying to walk with the Lord in the fallen world. And as such, they represent, in many cases, they will be a sort of a window into the heart of Jesus. Because when Jesus actually is going through as the Son of David, as a completely righteous Jew of the day, he's going to be encountering the same kind of situations David would have had. He was rejection by friends. Other than the things where David had done something wrong, our Lord didn't make those kind of mistakes. But apart from those, but misunderstanding, Judas being rejected by his enemies, abandoned by fair weather friends, having shortages of resources, having reversals where his cousin John the Baptist was beheaded right at the beginning of his ministry. There'd be periods of discouragement. There'd be things of this type. And how he would have sorted through that and argued through that with his father, we can see some of those like in the Psalms. Because that's what David is. David is a messianic figure. He's a precursor to the Lord Jesus. And so a lot of the issues, the quintessential version is Jesus wrestling in the Garden of Gethsemane with his impending becoming sin on our behalf. He was, of course, no stranger to discomfort, no stranger to pain. He's been familiar with our pain from creation. He weeps with those who weep. And so he knows what all that is. But the problem in the garden was that he was going to actually have to take the sin of the world on himself. And that, for somebody that's perfectly innocent and perfectly pure and perfectly beautiful, that's not a very exciting proposition. That's a tragedy, because it's going to mean a separation between him and his father in judgment. Granted, it's for love. It's so that we don't have to go there. He bore us in, so we don't have to bear it. We get off literally scot-free because of what he did there at the garden. But when he's wrestling with that, there are two levels of difficulty when he's wrestling with that. And you can see this in his heart. He knows he came specifically for this. You know, he's helping people all along, but all of a sudden he's confronted with the reality and he's wrestling with it. And so he takes his three closest friends with him, Peter, James, and John, and says, come watch with me for a few minutes. Just stand with me here, right? And so he goes and prays, and when he comes back, they've fallen asleep. You know, they're not agonizing with him. They just sort of abandoned him too. And this goes on three times, you know. So he comes back for like moral support, and they're not there. And so he goes back, and it's just on the strength of his love alone that he does it. And we get a glimpse into that struggle. Lord, he says, Father, if there's any other way to do this, let's do it. But if there's not, your will be done, not mine. Okay, that's where it ends. That's the bottom line for him, is obedience to the Father and in pursuit of love and our redemption and our rescue. And so we have the situation where that kind of struggle with various and sundry things. There were other smaller versions of that earlier in his ministry. But you see more of that in the Psalms. And so some of the Psalms, you can look at that and see perhaps a glimpse into the heart of Jesus as he lived as the righteous son of David, and see what kind of struggles he would have had when he walked into the temple and he found it filled with money changers and people were charging exorbitant interest and, you know, just making a beautiful place of worship into a commercial place. You know, I mean, you can imagine just the zeal and just the outrage at that and the travesty. You know, you can see what prompted the kinds of behavior and the kinds of things that he did. So I did want to mention that as we get through the Psalms, and I'll be pointing some of these out, how they're applied to the life of Jesus as we go forward. Okay, so Psalm 1, if you remember, was our very first starting psalm. Psalm 1 was that blessed is the person who doesn't listen to the bad stuff, the scoffers, the wicked, the people say, get ahead this way. But those who pay attention to Scripture, pay attention to instruction. We use the word Torah, remember, which was the Hebrew word for teaching, instruction. And sometimes instruction came from the word of Moses, from the Scripture. Sometimes it was watching how the ant put things up in the summer to make way, you know, to be okay for the winter. Sometimes it was looking at the field of the person who liked to take way too many naps, the sluggard. And looking at it, said, God's got an inordinate amount of weeds, doesn't it? You know, and the fence is broken down, and the animals are already eating all this. And what's he probably taking his mid-afternoon, midlife nap, like I like, you know? You know, just longer there, you know? And that's why I use an inordinate amount of naps. There is a, you know, an approved number of naps, but an inordinate number. And so instruction comes from that. You can learn from those experiences and things of this type. And by the same token, you can spend time in the Scripture and not get instruction. You can sit there to learn that, to be proud of it, or, you know, that kind of stuff to look good or something like that without listening to it and learning from it. Because when you go into Scripture, that's the point. You sit there and say, look, you know, I want to learn something from this. This is an instructional thing. I don't want to just, I want something that I can use and something that's practical, something that changes me. I use the example of, I don't want to master the Bible. I want the Bible to master me. I want it to master me. I want it to change me and challenge my life and bring change. Because it's the purest form of advice you can get. You know, there's a story in the Old Testament about one of the kings of the northern kingdom. Remember, when we have King David, we have one kingdom. We have the monarchy, it's called, of Israel. And then we have Solomon, his son, and it's still one nation. And then Solomon has that divided mind we talked about. He couldn't make up his mind whether he wanted fame and riches or wanted obedience and blessing of God. And then the nation splits into the northern and the south. Well, the northern king has got one of these things where he's trying to decide whether to go fight with Assyria. And so he asks his prophets, and there's 400 prophets that he's got, and they all say, go attack Assyria, you will be victorious. Right? But none of these are prophets of the Lord. You know, these are prophets of Baal and other gods locally. Right? And I remember an old preacher one time said, and let me just tell you, from the inside, being a pastor, he said, if you ever get 500 preachers to agree on something, you know it's wrong. Turn around and go in the opposite direction as fast as you can. And so he calls for one other prophet, and there's one prophet of Yahweh, of the Lord there, and they said, but I don't like, you know, calling him because he always speaks bad about me. I don't like his opinion. And the good king that's up visiting from Israel says, well, no, let's play it safe. Come on, don't talk that way about this guy. Bring him in. And he says, okay, so what is it, you know, what's your prophecy? And he says, yeah, go on off there and get killed. That's fine. And the king of the north says to the king of the south, see, I told you, he always says bad things about me. There's no reason I should be put him to death. He says, no, let's pay attention. So you can listen to religious figures, religious books, and technology, but you got to pay attention. You got to really look at and search out the Lord's heart and pray, you know, change me. It starts with that. Change me, teach me, instruct me. I want to be changed by this, whatever it is. You don't necessarily have to go away with something you know is changed, because it's going to change you if you approach it with a good heart anyway. And a lot of the changes that I notice he has to do in my life, he changes all the subterranean stuff first, and everything moves around inside my thoughts and my attitude. You know, it's nothing but blinding revelation until lo and behold, you know, 6 months later, this thing pops out of my mouth or pops out of my decision. And I thought, oh, wow. I didn't think I would ever actually get there to be able to where I could do that freely and comfortably and feel right and stuff like that, you know. So Psalm 1 was about instruction and where did you get your feed, where do you get your opinions as to what counts. Then Psalm 2, we started trying to apply that. Psalm 2, if you remember, was about the nations. Why are the nations at war? Why are they fighting against God and His king? And so there's now, David is faced with international war, so he's got to stop his people from partying and doing the crops, and he's got to now draft them into the military. They got to disrupt all their families. Now they got to go to war just to maintain status quo. You know, it's totally disruptive, you know, this kind of stuff, and he's got to trust God in this. And then Psalm 3 was, remember, where we had betrayal in his family, where he had messed up in his family real bad, and Absalom, remember, Absalom, his son, is now trying to kill him and take his job. And David's, part of the thing is David's not sure, but maybe that's the right thing for God to do, because he's been so bad. He's not sure. You know, his failure with Bathsheba, the murder of Uriah the Hittite, and the way he dealt with Absalom's, the rape of Absalom's sister, and, you know, all these failures, he said, well, maybe it is time to retire me. You know, maybe this is what I get. And so he has to trust the Lord, because he doesn't know. He can't sit there and say, I'm righteous, judge the wicked, you know, judge this, because it's not clear who's worse in this case, Absalom or David. And so that's Psalm 3. Psalm 4 we finished a couple weeks ago, was an anonymous where we didn't know, you know, the historical setting. But what we did know from it was, remember, was that there was no acceptance of guilt. The person, you know, the psalmist, you know, didn't say, I did something wrong. It's just somebody's out after me. I mean, these people are spreading rumors and lies about me, and I don't get it. I'm sick, and they figure that God's trying to bust me, you know, is judging me for being sick, and therefore I must be doing something wrong. And so they're trying to come up and imagine what all I've done wrong, and they've spread it out all over the internet. It's in the chat rooms, you know, stuff on the bulletin boards and everything. And so he doesn't know what to do with that, so he has to trust him in the Lord. We talked about, you know, the attacks on our character. And then we come to Psalm 5, and remember, Psalm 4, he was still doing good to these guys. He was saying, hey, look, you know, I don't want to pray for God to judge you. You know, I'm in a position where I could, but I don't want to pray. What I want specifically is you to be quiet on your bed and think about what you're doing and work through it between you and the Lord, and then get to a right place with the Lord or offer a right sacrifice and trust in Him. And if you've got a legitimate beef, trust it to the Lord and work through it that way instead of trying to take matters in your own hand and do your own stuff. When we get to 5, it's a little more serious because we step over a line. At 4, the attackers were damaging to his reputation, but it wasn't necessarily disruptive yet in the kingdom. In other words, he could still be patient with them a little longer before he had to intervene as a civic authority or invoke judgment. When we get to 5, he has to step across that line. And so we get into one of a difficult theological issue that we're going to hopefully get to tonight. Okay, so 5. We're going to start with, we're on page 28 in the syllabus. And it's got the Hebrew, and I read the English under the Hebrew. And again, we read on page 28, we read from right to left. Okay. Again, the title, For the One Directing for the Flutes, A Psalm of David. And again, that's that musical notation, you know, it's like, you know, scale and tempo. That would be what that would mean. It's just sort of like a little title. And the actual content of this psalm starts in verse 2 in this thing. But verse 2 is verse 1 in your English Bible. Okay, this is the way the Hebrew numbers. The titles have verse numbers in Hebrew, but they don't in English. So it's always sort of off by one. You always have to ask, you know, when you're reading the commentary that's talking about Hebrew verses versus English verses. My words, give ear, Yahweh, consider my sight. And we talked about that it starts out with Yahweh, and Yahweh, remember, is that covenant name. Remember, I ought to just leave it there, actually. We refer to it so often. But remember, we have 3 or 4 different names of God in the Old Testament Hebrew. We have Elohim, which is His title, and it's always translated God. capital G, little o, D, in the English Bible. And then Yahweh, which is God's covenant name, is always all caps Lord or all caps God. And Yahweh is the name that he reveals to Abraham in the covenant, and he doesn't reveal it to the other nations. And so it's a private name of those who have a special relationship. They're in a special relationship. God has called Abraham out to bless the world through Abraham. He didn't just play favorites. He didn't say, come on, Abraham, I'm going to bless you and nobody else. He said, no, I'm going to bless everybody else through you. And so normally things like selection or election, or scriptural terms like that, is generally election or choosing to service, not to blessing, not to salvation itself. So most of the scriptural passages about each. So Yahweh is the covenant name, and Yahweh is his covenant name. So he's appealing here to that special relationship where God chose the Jews to be a blessing to the Gentiles. In the famous passage in the Moses' law, he says, I have chosen you to be a kingdom of priests. See, the whole nation were supposed to be priests in the Old Testament sense, being teachers. They were supposed to plead to God. The priests had two jobs, basically to teach, to represent man to God, and represent man to God in terms of gifts and offerings. That's what they were supposed to do. And that was their job. And the Jews were supposed to be that for the Gentiles. They were supposed to be out there spreading the word to us so we wouldn't just wander around as strange paganism stuff. You know, and at the same time, every time we messed up, they were supposed to say, Lord, just, you know, Glenn messed up again. Can you just forgive him one more time here? Maybe after we do the lesson next week, maybe he'll learn. You know, maybe he won't do that again. He appeals here, David here, because of this covenant relationship with Yahweh. He appeals and says, give ear, O Yahweh. So he's implicitly reminding the Lord of that special relationship that he has. Okay? Consider my sighing. And we pointed out, remember, about the sighing was that that's just a groan. That's a groan. That's not a real articulate. That's not reading out of the liturgy. Let's all turn to page 233 and read that prayer. This is not one of those. Unless that prayer is where you push it for the sound that says, ah! If it's one of those, like you open a little birthday card and say, ah! You know, if it's one of those, that's the kind of prayer we're talking about here. Listen to my words. Starts with words and ends with sigh. So he means well, but he's going to end up just crying in pain there. Three, listen to the voice. It says, you've got sound there, but it's the word kol, which is the word voice. Bat kol is a voice from heaven, for example. So kol is listen to the voice of my cry for help. Okay? You know, my cry itself has a voice. It's not, I mean, it's that bad of a pain. My cry itself, you just listen to it, the cry itself will communicate how bad this is. My cry has a voice itself. For my help, my king, and that's Melech, and that's king, and Melech, remember, is the word for, like in Melchizedek. Melchi is the word for king. Melchizedek. Zedek is the word for righteousness. Melchizedek is king of righteousness. And Melech just means king. And so David reminds God, first of all, that he's, hey, you're in charge of our covenant. You're the Yahweh in this relationship. And I think I'm going to mention a little bit about suzerainty treaties in a few minutes now that I think about it. But he also says, you're a Melech. You're also my king. So not only are you, you know, close to me from a covenant relationship, you're also the moral governor. You can't sit there as king and look at this and let this go on. I mean, this is damaging not only your reputation, the way the outsiders see us, demoralizing all the troops inside the city. You know, you're the king. Come on, you got to do something here. You got to act. And then he goes one more step and he says, my king, and then he says, and my God. And that's where the word God is the Elohim title, which is the big God, which is the term for God's job, like president or monarch. But it's bigger than king, because there were kings that were under Elohim. And Elohim is God or awesome ruler, basically. So it's big God. Okay? And so he appeals to, in these two verses, he calls on God in three different names. You know, Yahweh, king, and God, ruler, basically. And so he's bringing out all the guns here to try to get the attention of the Lord to say, look upon the situation by every criteria, the specialness of our relationship, your rule as a direct king, your moral governor all over the universe. You know, you really ought to do something here and listen to my puny little cry for help. That's a real groan, and pay attention, please. And so he says, and my God, for to you I pray. And the to you is emphatic in the passage. Instead of saying, because I pray to you, it's because to you I'm praying. In other words, you ought to listen because it's just you that I'm appealing to. I'm not asking anybody else. I'm not sending out form letters to whom it may concern. Can you come help me? You know, this is to you. Okay? And it's an emphatic because of the word order there. So, to you, listen to me, because it's you I'm counting on. I'm depending upon you when I pray. Yahweh, there he uses the covenant word again. Yahweh, yeah, let me stop and mention the Susan T. Treaty. Okay. In the second millennium B.C., okay, and that's when Moses is about somewhere, Moses is in Egypt, and Israel are in Egypt, somewhere between 1400 B.C. and 1200 B.C. That's roughly when the Exodus occurs. We don't know which one of those dates. And they've been in there for 400 years. Remember, Abraham was 400 years, and God appeared to Abraham when he made all these covenants. He said, now your people, let me tell you, I'm going to give you all this land, but your people are going to be a servant in a strange land and bondage for 400 years. But when the people in this land get so bad that I'm justified for kicking them out, to use the phrase, when the iniquity of the Amorites are full, okay, when they get so bad that I cannot be patient any longer with them, or it's destructive on everybody else, then I'm going to bring Israel out, and we're going to kick these folk out, and I'll give your descendants the land like I promised. I can't do it yet, because your guys aren't a whole lot better than them right now, but they're going to get so much worse that, relatively speaking, you'll be really good, you know, by the time they get really bad. Okay, so he makes that promise. Well, at the time Moses is there, and remember, Moses is a statesman. He's a politician, actually. He's raised, remember they take him out of the basket, right? And it's Pharaoh's daughter that raises him as his own. Oh, so he's educated in all the wisdom of Egypt, is what Scripture says. So he knows all the pagan literature. He knows all the hieroglyphics. He knows all the legal forms of the day. And the legal forms are like templates, like when you go in to do a will, or you go in to do a dissolution or judgment or something. You know, they're standard legal contracts, right? Well, there was a form back then called a suzerainty treaty. And this was where a big nation would approach a little nation, or a little nation would approach a big one and said, hey, let's make a contract. Let's make a suzerainty treaty. We'll be the vassals. We'll serve you, and we'll let you be the suzerain, which was the king or the emperor. Okay, we'll make this agreement, and it's sort of like a political alliance. Okay, your job as the suzerain is to protect us when we are attacked by other big suzerains. Okay, you are to protect us and teach us your ways and protect us. And in return, we won't be treacherous from inside. Because that was one of the worst things that could happen in the ancient Near East, is you adopted a people that came to you for refuge. They came inside, and then they had escaped from their master, you know, some other country. And they say, well, the best way to get back in the graces of this other country is to do an internal rebellion and be spies and be traitors. And then we can cause the big nation to fall before our other friends. And then we're reinstated with grace and power and money. Right? This happened all the time. All the time. And this was part of why when the new king rose that didn't know Joseph in Egypt, he was afraid of the Israelites. They were so powerful, and said that, you know, we were concerned that they might arise against us. See, and that actually happened in history roughly around that time in a separate episode about the Hyksos, which is a separate thing altogether. Okay, but at the time, there was this form for a treaty called a Hittite Suzerainty Treaty. And that is the form. It has a preamble. It states the rules and responsibilities of the suzerain, the ruler, and of the vassal. And it has the terms and conditions of what you have to do. It has the list of all the blessings that will happen to you if you do obey the stipulations that in the contract. You'll get all this you know, all this great stuff will happen to you, and here's the penalty clauses. Here's what happens if you don't. If you go bad for 30 days, here's what happens. If you go bad for 90 days, we escalate it. If it goes bad eventually, you know, eventually I may kick you out of the land that I gave you, and I'm protecting you, which is what the exile was about. Well, this is the form. The book of Deuteronomy is in that covenant form, more or less. It actually divides up into those actual covenants. It's a second millennium legal document, the book of Deuteronomy. It's got a little at the front, a little at the end, like the death of Moses and stuff like that. But otherwise, it's set up with, and you deposited the copy of the contract in a safe place, like they did the tabernacle. When they wrote the law, they had the little Ark of the Covenant, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, that box. And they put that inside the little tabernacle, and that was the witness. They had two copies. And so it was a contract that said, if I do this, this is what I get. If I don't do this, this is what I get. And it was purely spelled out, and every Israelite says, hey, that's a good deal. Sign me up. And then had Moses warn them and said, now you better be careful before you really say you really want this, because I know what you're going to do, and I know what I'm going to have to do. And I'll wait as long as I can before I invoke the penalty clauses. But when you start destroying one another and sacrificing your children in the fires of Molech, enough's enough. I'm gonna kick you out of the land because you're just as bad as the Amorites that I kicked out for child sacrifice and all these other things that they did. Okay, so that was the contract that established the relationship between the what we call the Mosaic covenant, the covenant that Moses made with Yahweh, which is different than the covenant Abraham made with Yahweh. Abraham's covenant is what we call an unconditional covenant. God comes to Abraham and says, here's what I'm going to do. It don't matter what I'm going to do through you, here's what it is. You don't have any, you know, there's no parity in this. These are not two equal parties making this relationship at all. When it comes to Moses' covenant, all of the law, we have that situation where very specific rules and regulations. Here's what you do. Here's the festivals. Here's the way you honor our relationship. And here's the way I'll respond. Okay? So Israel is aware that if I do good things, God will bless me because he's covenanted under this name Yahweh. And that's how they could appeal to them. They could sit there and say, you should bless me, God, not because I'm good, but because you're good. And you said that this is the way you want to do business. So if I walk clean, and I don't have to be sinless, but when I sin, I just have to do a sacrifice and be honest about it and forgive it and get up and pick up and keep moving. You know, I can't wallow in it and stuff like this. So that's all that was required, you know, on the part of the Lord. It wasn't perfection. It was just being able to do it. But we don't even do that. You know, a lot of times when we do something wrong, we just don't want to fight about it. You know, I mean, we're not ready to give up yet. You know, that's a separate issue, and that's a human heart problem that we'll get to later in the book of Psalms. So, Yahweh is a covenant term, and there are two sides of that. That's that Abrahamic covenant and that Mosaic covenant. Okay. So, verse 4. Yahweh, in the morning, you hear my voice. There's that cold word again. You hear my voice. In the morning, I lay my request before you, and I wait. And I lay my request word is an ambiguous word because it was the word that was used for arranging like a sacrifice. So when you were preparing something to give to God, like an offering or something like this, you had to arrange it in a certain little order, and there was this, you know, little thing like this. But it was also the word that you would use in court. When you would make a defense or an appeal to a judge, you would arrange your arguments, you know, to where everything would support your case and it was the clearest as possible to the judge why he needed to act and how he needed to act, or in some cases how she needed to act in the Old Testament. You know, you would put the case out there like that. And so here was a situation where he says, you know, my voice you're going to hear in the morning, and I'm going to lay out the case. And then remember we talked about that next word, and I wait. I lay my request before you, and I wait. I'm going to wait out in the lobby while you act, God. It's that presumptive close. You know, it's an assumption, assumptive close. I wait. In the English translation, it says, I eagerly and expectantly wait for your answer. I know you've told me what you do and what you like and the way to do this, and you know my heart. I can't manipulate you by ritual. you know, you'll bust me much faster than you'll bust my enemies if I just go ritual on you. I mean, this is a heart. It's a relationship thing. And so my relationship inside the ritual is beautiful, perfect, wonderful. And so on the basis of that, I'm going to sit out in the lobby, if you don't mind, court judge, and wait for you to do your thing. Just wake me up. I'm going to take a nap now that I've made my appeal to you. I don't have to worry anymore about this. Okay? So I wait expectantly. That's a beautiful thing. And then we had that odd switch in verse 5. Remember, for God is not pleased in evil. You not, he can dwell with you, the wicked. Now we ask, how did we get this change? Now there's two ways it could possibly be the case. And I'll tell you the first one. One way of understanding that is that saying that you're going to hear my prayer because I'm not one of those wicked. Okay, doesn't sort of fit. The because doesn't make a whole lot of sense there. But the next two or three verses indicate that basically it says, you're going to answer my prayer because you don't listen to the people who are praying and fighting against me. The evil people. They're evil people that are out after me that I'm about to describe here. Wicked people. They're people of power. Okay, and they really don't belong in your court. Because he's appealed to him. It's a courtroom image. Remember, you got the king and the emperor, the Elohim. It's all a governor. He's appealing to an authority to help him here. And so his statement is that, I think you're going to answer my prayer. I've made this appeal in court because the other people that are trying to appear in your court right now are not going to be able to stay there for very long because they're not the right kind of people in your court. You are not a God who takes pleasure in evil. It doesn't matter how rich they are, how powerful they are, how smooth talking they are, as we're going to see, how smooth their tongues are. You know, if you see the heart, and if the heart's not in the right place, all that ability and all that talent and all that resources and all that good talking is not going to stand because you see right through it. You cut to the chase, you see exactly what the heart is. And so therefore, all of their machinations that you ought to judge me and punish me and drive me out and banish me and stuff like this is not going to stand. That's why I can wait expectantly, because I know you well enough. I know your heart that you don't like those kinds of things. You'll drive them out and then start trying to teach them and reform them like you've had to do me before. You know, because David, we'll have a number of Psalms where David's on the wrong end of this, where he goes in and said, okay, you've been busting me. I'm trying to learn my lesson here. You've driven me away, you know, and now I'm trying to learn from this. So he's confident that God is going to answer because God is not pleased in evil. And not he can dwell with you wicked. Now, one thing I didn't mention last time was the can dwell with you is translated sometimes as dwell as a resident alien. And what that meant in Israel, a land was assigned by tribe, right? The ancient Near Eastern was like this. I mean, everything was land-based. You know, there were no other things other than land to keep you alive. And so land passed from father to father to son, sometimes through daughters and things of this type, daughters of Zelophehad. So it passes through. And so land is everything. Land is everything, okay? And therefore, it's all owned by Jews in Israel, right? It's all owned by Jews in ancient Israel. Well, a resident alien was somebody that sat there and watched what God did for Israel and said, you know, I need to be a part of that. I mean, you know, I'm selfish enough to give up, you know, my god Dagon and, you know, Chemosh and Marduk and all these other silly-sounding names or whatever. And I'll go and become an Israelite, but I can't become a true Israelite because I don't have the blood. See, I'm not the blood. Now, you actually could. You could, later in Israel, you could actually be adopted into Judaism. You could take an oath, be circumcised, and actually be grafted into a family. And there are some of the genealogies and chronicles show individuals that are like that. We know of plenty of those. God never kicks anybody out for that reason, believe me. And so, but there was another category where you could just come and be a resident alien. So you moved into the land. Israel would let you go in there, especially if you were escaped from an abusive master or abusive country. You could come in and, it was required in the law of Moses to give you land. Let you live on land. You wouldn't necessarily get it, but you would be like a tenant farmer. But you'd get free rent, and you could earn some of that, and you could gather possessions and things of this type. But they were not supposed to hassle you. So when God is giving in Exodus the Ten Commandments, before as he starts this, the first set of commandments he gives, long before he gets to sacrifices, tithes, he says, do not oppress the foreigner who lives among you, because remember what it was like for 400 years. He said, that's that old golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do, put yourself, walk in another person's muck. He said, don't you dare go down that road of mistreating the foreigner that wants to live among you at a refuge, because remember what it was like when you were the foreigner in Egypt and they mistreated you for 400 years. Don't do that ever to anybody. I don't like that. I don't like people that feel that. And I don't want you to do it to anybody else. I want you to always remember from where you came that you are a rescued sinner. That you are rescued, fallen. You are no better than anybody else and no worse than anybody else. And so, therefore, you accept everybody that I accept. Anybody that I accept, you take them in there too. So the resident alien had special privileges, a special protection. They got some of the tithes. When I'd take my best crops, a couple times at the harvest festival, I'd take it to Jerusalem, and we were going to party. Okay, some of those crops went to guess who? Resident aliens that were not doing well. It went to the widows. It went to the fatherless, the orphans, the people that were destitute. They were there at the table, at the potluck, enjoying that. God cared for these people. So he says that these people are foreigners in God's court, and they can't even participate at that level. They're so alien from God's way. And see, to be a resident alien in ancient Israel, you had to see eye to eye with Israel. Right? You can't be a traitor. You have to believe in Israel, because why else would you go there? You got to believe in it, see opportunity. You got to fit moral-wise in ancient Israel to be a resident alien. And what he's saying here is that these wicked they can't even dwell as resident aliens, because they don't even see things the way you do, Lord. They don't care about goodness. They don't care about patience. They don't care about forgiveness. They don't care about giving somebody the benefit of the doubt. They don't care about not slandering. They don't care about, trying to help somebody that's fallen. They're too quick to judge and all this kind of stuff. Whatever, And so he makes that point that the wicked just flat cannot dwell with you as a resident alien. 6. Not they can stand, the ones being arrogant, before your eyes. You hate all the ones who do wrong. And we talked about there about the problem of arrogance in depth last time. About the problem with arrogance was that it divides. Remember, we talked about the whole point of arrogance. As soon as I get, better than somebody else, there's a division there between the two. I mean, I'll have to come down off my high horse to help them. As opposed to if we were just peers, I would just have to get over being lazy. See, it's a separate set of challenges to come off a high horse to help somebody and admit that they're a peer. For goodness sake, ask them for help. That's really bad. If you're better than them, to ask them for help. And God is always doing that among us. At the slightest level of arrogance, and he seems to go after this. But remember, arrogance divided. Remember, we talked about theologically, that's the definition of death. Death was separation. Remember, we talked about physical death was separation of the soul from the body. Spiritual death was separation of the soul from God. Just day-to-day death is where I'm separated from myself. I'm alienated. Just, here's where I want to be, but here's how I'm acting. I'm not at peace with myself. I'm conflicted. And so death has many different forms, and sin causes it, things of this type. And that's what this arrogance is about. It just creates an impossible society. It creates barriers in the community. You just can't get as much done. It's when people are, it's amazing, like crises like this, the best that humans ever are in the face of massive devastation and problems. And they're only good for a couple of days. And then, when things start getting a little easier and they start getting in photo ops and, all this kind of stuff, then the world changes again. It's just amazing that, we all have this problem where the third arm starts growing out of our back to come back around and start patting ourselves on the back about how good we are to the less fortunate. This kind of thing. You just can't get away from that part of our bane here, our curse. But in this particular case, the arrogance, like I say, is a huge problem, and this is what David is up against. The arrogant are somehow, they're wicked. They just can't stand forever in front of God's eyes in the court. And, human courts can tolerate that. I was telling, who was I telling about the... Well, it may have been this group about the appropriate arrogance levels, about what the criteria for... Maybe it was somebody else, obviously. I talk about senior executives because I worked in corporate America and have for all these years. And at the big companies, you know, the big senior vice president types and stuff, they get puffed up a little bit every now and then. You know, and they get what they tend to think are appropriate arrogance levels. You know, they've earned it. And at some level, if you've earned a credibility like that, it's a little bit okay. As long as it doesn't, you know, destroy your ability to get your work done, work with your people, stuff like that. So, yeah, we talk about appropriate arrogance levels and inappropriate arrogance levels. And I remember back in seminary when I was working through this the first time, I was thinking, because God was really blessing me in terms of grades and, you know, and looking good to the teachers and all this kind of stuff, you know, that kind of stuff that would, a normal schoolboy could easily go into this arrogant mode. You could just hit that switch and there you're there. And I remember working through this one time God humbled me some wonderfully powerful way. Wasn't very visible, I'm sure, but I remember thinking, I think that you could have criteria for when it would be legitimate to be arrogant. And the two criteria I came up with is, if one, you could speak a universe into existence. If you had that much power, you could probably, you know, it'd be reasonable to be arrogant, or you could raise yourself from the dead.
Did
I tell you that? Okay. And that, yeah, okay, that one there. And those were the only two things I figured that you could have a legitimate claim to arrogance. And then, like I say, once you got that far advanced, why would you need to? Right. I mean, that was the point. Who would have the heart to? Who cares? At that level, you know, you're not out to prove anything to anybody. You know, so why do you need to be feeling better about yourself by feeling worse about somebody else? Why do you have to feel good at somebody else's bad expense, right? Okay. So the arrogance, God typically doesn't like arrogance. And like I say, it's in those top three or four sins in the Old Testament. One's being arrogance for your eyes. You hate, and hate there is not just an attitude, it's actually active opposition. So as a king, he had this job. That was part of what a king's job is to go after all the ones that are doing wrong. Everybody that's out there, and these are not... I wrote a note to mention that anytime we have wrong words in the Old Testament and the Psalms, they are felonies, not misdemeanors. They are really bad wrongs. They are destructive wrongs. They're not mistakes, minor misdemeanors. You know, these are really destructive things. And so a king has a police function. It has a judicial function. The king has to go do this. And, it'll forgive the first five times. You know, I mean, there's this escalating thing that you do with people. But eventually, at some point, it's too destructive of the community if he's going to kill everybody that moves next to him. You know, I went through three neighbors before I decided to throw him in jail. I probably should have acted sooner, you know. And so God has this role to be actively involved against those that are doing wrong. And remember, wrong is destructive in the world. Wrong actually tears stuff up. I mean, and there's almost no wrong that you could do that does not weaken somebody. Either you or a friend or a mate or something. Some kind of treachery, any kind of treachery, betrayal, failure, it weakens somebody's ability to trust you. And that weakens how much more they can get done. I mean, perfect teams work together because they depend upon everybody else to do their job. And nobody has to waste time thinking about, are they going to do their job this time, or are I going to have to take up the slack for them? So you don't have to get into all the second guessing who's going to fail stuff. It's like if everybody's faithful and does their responsibility. And God builds, you know, stretch and, you know, slack into the system to make sure it can work in a fallen world. But what you don't want to have to worry about is somebody... I tell you what, I'll get in front of you and run a point of that. What you don't have to want to worry about is a knife in your back. You can't afford treachery. And so part of what the king's supposed to do in the Old Testament is supposed to weed out the treacherous. So we try to work on the treacherous. We have to teach them to be less treacherous first. And then to be treacherous only on their beds as they're working through it in their own life until finally they come to decide to be not, you know, treacherous. And eventually want them to be reverse treacherous, where they go out and they try to heal wounds caused by the treachery, including their own, and be a positive contribution. See that cycle there from treacherous to less treacherous to quietly treacherous to not neutrally treacherous to anti-treacherous, reverse treacherous. Okay? So God has a responsibility to do this. Seven, you destroy the ones telling lies. And again, that's a felony lie. That's not just a mild type of deceit. That's a deceit that hurts somebody. That's libel. That's a slander. False witness in court. That's a perjury. That's fraud. I mean, it's something that actually actively hurts, destroys community, destroys somebody's life, puts them in a worse situation. That's what that kind of lie is. The other thing I should mention there in verse 7 is the verb you destroy is a particular Hebrew tense, the imperfect, which in this case means one of two things. It's either a future, you will destroy the ones telling lies, or a typical, which means you typically destroy those who tell lies. In other words, one of the problems that we'll see throughout the Scripture, especially in the Psalms, is the wicked do get ahead for a while. And so God's supposed to deal with those folk, you know, but the problem is he's always patient. That's a problem. I've reflected upon this so many times, especially on the think tank, writing about why does God allow evil, you know, and stuff like this. And God has two choices. He either, the second evil raises its other, he pops it and busts it and punishes it immediately. And he comes off as being a harsh, brutal God, right? That's his choice. Or he's patient with evil and lets them do, waiting for them to reform, trying to work on them while they hurt other people. And then he's accused of being soft on crime. So if you're, I mean, you can't win this one if you're God. You can't. You're either going to be brutal or soft on crime, and people are going to say, "Why aren't you? You're not involved, God, in our lives, and blah blah, because all this bad happens." Or God, he's so unforgiving, so impatient, never gives you any slack here to change your life. I was just about to reform my life when you wham took me out there, and it tells you something about God. If he has to pick between those two, and he's going to take a hit for one of them. The fact that he takes the hit on being patient and giving us chances to get better, to heal and clean and help one another, that tells you a little, if he's going to get busted for it, and he opts for that, that tells you more about his heart than him running a perfectly sterile planet. See? That tells you a little bit about his heart, that when we get in those situations where we should be judged, you know, I shouldn't have said that, I should have responded differently to that situation, that we know that, okay, the reason I'm not busted for this is you want me to come to you, Father. And so I come to you, Lord. And so there are times, like I say, we had to draw the line. And he says, enough's enough. I got to kick you out of the land. I got to exile you. I got to, you know, take you out or whatever. So those do happen. you destroy either typically or you will destroy the ones telling lies. Excuse me. The man of bloodshed and deceit. Excuse me. The man of bloodshed and deceit. And remember, deceit here is coupled with bloodshed. So it's not, again, it's not just lying and, you know, I'm sort of hedging the truth a little bit. This is a violent kind of deceit. This is actually going to get somebody in trouble. It may get them killed if it's perjury. You know, they may lose their farm and their family if it's fraud. You know, those types of things, right? So it's a very violent kind of this, and God hates that. And God just literally. And the thing is that some people say, well, gosh, I mean, boy, again, good point about the judgment, but he responds so negatively to, you know, lies and deceit. You know, he ought to be more patient. Well, he is patient. That doesn't mean that he has to like the evil that you're doing to his kids or his friends or his people or his world or yourself. See? One of the measures is one of the things you think about in terms of the wrath of God. When you run across the Old Testament phrase "wrath of God," even though it doesn't mean like we think of wrath as just this violent outrage thing, the wrath of God is actually a government term. It was something that governors did. Nakam was a role that the governor had to do, was to right injustices, and, you know, the things you stole you had to give back, and they had, you know, that's what wrath is about there. But the moral outrage aspect is when you read in the newspaper of things like child abuse or crimes, vandalism against the elderly, right, or just stupid crime, vandalism just by itself, you know, where there's nothing to be gained from just destroying somebody else's life, you know, a murder for the fun of it, you know, those types of crimes. If the heart doesn't feel this intense moral outrage at that, then something's wrong. The plumbing is not working. It's okay to sit there and start praying for that individual. You know, that God would divert them, change them, whatever is there, whatever the opportunity is still there. But that doesn't mean that I have to not be upset over what was done. And God does. He's upset with wickedness every day because it always hurts somebody. More or less, and He feels every bit of it, but it's always there. And so, a moral wrong, God sees wrong. He responds to evil, wickedness, with two almost instantaneous feelings. One is this one about anger, moral outrage at what the damage that was done to themselves and to others. And the second one is grief, or and occasionally frustration. It says that Israel vexed his heart, frustrated his heart in the wilderness. Well, there's a frustration, I want to do this to bless you. And just everywhere I want to bless you, you sit there and just spurn it. You just won't go there. You just rather do your own stuff and wallow in your own misery instead of just taking a free loaf of bread here, guys. You know. And so there's that element of anger at moral outrage, but immediately there's also this thing of grief for that individual and for the situation, a sadness that, you know, prompts rescue and redemption and things of this type. You hate all the ones doing wrong. You destroy the ones telling lies. Man of bloodshed and deceit, you abhor Yahweh. There's that covenant word again. But I, verse 8, strong contrast, starts out, you don't normally use the word I. I is normally part of the verb, like it is in Spanish. You don't say yo hablo, you know, you just say hablo. You don't normally put yo on unless you're trying to make some kind of point or distinguish it from some other form. And the same thing with Hebrew. You normally wouldn't use the word I unless you were trying to point attention. But I, in distinction to these people, the aforementioned people, Lord, you know, but I, instead, by the greatness of your mercy, I will come into your house. Now, it's interesting that what he doesn't say here. He doesn't say, but I, by the greatness of my character, or the goodness of my deeds will come into your house. He knows not to go there, because then he's going to be approaching an arrogance level, you know. And he just said these other folk are there. So he says, look, the difference is between people who do evil and the people who throw themselves upon the mercy of God. I wrote somebody one time, I said there's only two kind of people. There are reluctant sinners, and then there are happy sinners. There's sinners who like to sin, take delight in how much they can scam and get ahead and wheel around and look righteous and do evil. And then there's the reluctant sinners, those who do wrong and say, I don't like that in my life. I don't want to be that way. Change me. I don't like the way I snap judge. I don't like the way I snip at these people. I don't like the way I respond coldly or whatever. You know, but I do it. And it's reluctant. I don't like it. I want you to change me, Lord. Down here, hopefully down here before I get completely changed on the other side, and it's completely gone. So this is David won't go there because I'm good. You know, you take me into your temple so that I can just, you know, strut around like a rooster or a peacock or something like this because of my good works. He says, rather, by the greatness of your chesed, your loving, your loyal love, and this is the word that's generally translated love in the Old Testament, chesed. And when in one of those psalms where it says, you know, they've got that singing in the round thing where they said, Aaron, sons of Aaron, for the loving kindness of the Lord, for the Lord's love endures forever. Oh, you sons of Jacob, the Lord's love is forever. And they'll go through this singing, you know, antiphonally. You know, there's a psalm that we'll get to that, you know, in about 30 years, you know, it's in the hundreds, so, you know, it's going to be the 30 years, you know, where they sing alternating like this, and that's the word chesed, because his chesed is forever. And chesed is the word when he used in the covenant, the covenant with Moses. He says, my love will be upon you, and my loyal love, it's a covenant love. I have agreed to pick Abraham as a disciple, and I'm going to love you guys to the end of the earth. It's not only part of who I am, but I've got this external document. If you ever doubt it, you point me to this, and I'll sit there and say, okay, good point. It's in the law right there. I'll go do it. I'll be happy to obey my own will. And so this word chesed is loyal love. Remember, it's not mercy. Remember we talked about mercy and grace as being Hannah, Kanach. Is that word, we get the word Hannah is grace and mercy in the Old Testament. And so this is loyal love. This is that covenant love. It's an aggressive love. It's a love that believes the best as long as it can. It doesn't rejoice in false. It's always true. It knows your limitations, but it always stays after you. It's that Jesus picking Judas and never giving up on him. Staying with him all the way. It's that loyal love that stays on. And he says, by the greatness of your love, I will come into your house. I will bow toward your temple, the temple of your holiness, in reverence of you. Okay, now, house is just the word Beth or Beth. You know, we talked about, like, Beth is just that, like, Bethlehem was house of bread. Lehem was the word bread, and Bethlehem was house of bread where the bread of life came from, remember. And Beth Bar Shalom, like a Jewish synagogue would be Beth Bar Shalom, the house of the Son of Peace. You know, Bar was Aramaic for son, Barabbas, son of my father, you know. Couldn't think of anything more original than the son of my father. I don't know. That's a separate issue, you know. Better than being named Nabal, remember, which meant fool. You know, and you thought, boy, she wasn't getting along with her husband that day. Name the son fool after him. You know, boy, he wouldn't remember that every day. Hey, Nabal, I mean, son, come on in here. You know, and so, Beth, come into your house. I will bow towards your temple. Now, the temple hadn't been built yet. Remember, this is David. Who builds the temple? Solomon builds the temple. Remember, David's a man of war. He wants to build a temple. He goes to God and says, I want to build you a temple and build a house. Here I am in a house of cedar, and you're over there in that tarpaulin tent. Granted, it's weatherproof. It's actually made out of porcupine skins. They carried those around in the wilderness, actually. That's how they waterproof things. We use porcupine skins. You can figure out where they got that in the desert of Arabia. I'll let you work through that. But it wasn't from, like, rain out of heaven. It wasn't that kind of stuff, right? Actually, I'll tell you where it came from. When the Egyptians, on the night of the Passover, see, I can't even do a quiz. I'd give you a test. And I'd say, if you pause longer than a second, okay, here's the answer. That's why I was a miserable failure at the homeschooling for 1 year. Whatever. So, on the night of the Passover, you remember, Egypt has plundered the Israelites for 40 years. You know, 400 years they've been their slaves. They've used them for all their slave labor for 400 years, gotten rich off of them. Basically, they provided so much good. And on the night of the Passover, after all the plagues, and now everybody in Egypt is scared of the Israelites for the first time they've ever known, God told the Israelites to go to their neighbor Egyptians and ask for presents. Ask for jewels, ask for goodies, whatever. And he said, they will give it to you this time. They will give you back all the stuff that you gave them over 400 years. He used the phrase, you will plunder the Egyptians voluntarily. And that's where they did. They went there and they got all the gold and all the stuff that they're going to end up putting in the tabernacle and all the little, you know, the beautiful scenes and all the clasps and all the silver and gold. All of that, including porpoise skins, would have been given by the rich Egyptians to the Israelites. And they left. And Moses would remind them, hey, look, you will not want for anything in the land because you plundered the Egyptians on the night of the Passover. And so they gave them all those things, and they carried that out when they left the land of Egypt. And so they had the stuff that they needed to make, you know, the tents and stuff like that, and the fancy cloth. They had purple cloth and the incense that they needed and things of this type. Now, there would have also been traders, by the way, for things like olive oil and stuff like that in the wilderness. The nomads would always come through. So there would be some trade opportunities. As you can imagine, it was a great market opportunity for nomads to have 1.5 million Jews out in the middle of the, you know, wandering around the desert, you know. And so, but anyway, I got on there. Oh, the temple. So David, he said, you're a man of war, so I'm not going to let you do it. But I'll give you a son of peace, Solomon, and he will build the temple for me. And because you thought about this, instead I'm going to build you a house, a dynasty. That if you walk before me, your successive kings, sons of David, will reign in Israel. And one of your sons, I will sit on the throne forever and ever and ever. And that's our son of David, the Lord Jesus Christ. Right? He gets that title forever and ever and ever. And so he'll fulfill his covenant promise to David that way. His chesed, his loyal love to David. And so, but the tabernacle, which is just a tent, you know, at the time of David, is still called the temple. It's basically called a temple, just as they would call a little shrine a temple, you know, back in those days. Israel was not supposed to have a lot of shrines or temples. They were supposed to be at a certain... But before they had the big temple of Solomon, they were still worshiped at various places. When they came through the land, when they came out of Egypt, they had the ark, you know, and they built this out in the wilderness in Sinai, and they built that ark, and they had the Ark of the Covenant, then they had the tabernacle, which was the tent, and they had curtains around it, that the high priest would go in, and they would have a courtyard, and they have all these various little washing bowls and altars, and they had all this kinds of stuff that, you know, is part of the Mosaic Law. Well, when they got into the land, instead of that all keeping together, that all got broken up. And so the tent went someplace, the ark went someplace, the lavers went someplace, you know, and those would be where they would worship. And so they would go to a local shrine. It would be almost like relics were, you know, in the older days, where there was some special little holy place because some holy person had been there and left something. And so, you know, that was a good worship place. And those later turned into what we call the high places, which are very, very bad because they're associated with hill gods. But that's another story to be told at another time. So so David wants to go into the house. He said, I'm going to come in there. The only way I'm coming in is by your mercy, by your loyal love. That's how I get in, not by my goodness, by the cleanness of my hands. There'll be another verse, there'll be another song, by the way, where he'll plead the cleanness of his hands. He'll come in and say, you know, look upon the cleanness of my hands, how I have obeyed your law, O God, O Yahweh specifically. Right? Because you can see he's appealing to those that if I do this, this is my loyal, my commitment to you is to follow this instruction. Okay? I will come into your house, I will bow toward the temple of your holiness. Holiness, remember, was Kadesh. That word meaning different. Holiness is Kadesh. It just means something different. It could be different bad or different good. Most of the time in the Old Testament, it was different good, but not always. Priests that were separated from just normal kinds of occupations, they were just supposed to live in the temple, and they were just supposed to be paid for by the tithes and stuff like that. They were Kadeshed to the Lord. They were holy to the Lord. They were separated unto the Lord. Okay? And that's what Kadesh meant. The pagans that they drove out, they had Kadesh prostitutes at their temples. So they had sacred prostitution, male and female, and they were called Kadeshites. They were set apart from doing regular things to doing questionable activities in the name of their local deities, spreading no telling what all kinds of diseases and morals and destroying whatever. And that's part of why God waited for the iniquity of the Amorites to be full and drove them out. And when Israel gets there doing the same thing, he drives them out too. And they do get there. And actually they get a little worse than the nations that do. But Kadesh just means separated for some specific task. Okay, and generally it's good. Okay, it's really one of the sweet things about God's law in the Old Testament. The highest rank, quote unquote, was the high priest, Aaron, right? Aaron was the only person that could actually go in behind the curtain and not be killed. God says, only one, Moses, you can't go in. You can build it, you can set it up, but you can't ever go in there once I get Aaron set up and everything's like this. We'll talk face to face as we're getting into the land, but once we get it set up, only Aaron, not his sons. Nobody else goes in there until he dies, and this whoever is the appointee after him goes in there. Okay, so nobody else goes in there. Okay, and the rules that we have for that level of holiness has to do with like hair and you know, purity in your life and abstinence from certain things and you know, strong drink for a while and things of this type. They were able to drink wine all day long. They just couldn't do it before ceremonies and stuff like this. I mean, it wasn't a harsh kind of deal, but there were levels of purity and ritual purity that they had to go. Well, strangely enough, in the Old Testament, there's a special thing that anybody can have called taking a Nazarite vow. It's a very small little passage in the book of Moses. Just a commoner, man or woman, could go and dedicate the next 6 weeks of their life or 6 months of their life to serving God, either at the temple or in teaching or something of that type. Building. You could be building, you know, a priest house or something like that, or just helping the poor. They could take this vow. And the ritual purification that they had to go through was equal to the high priest. In other words, it was the same level of closeness to God and access to God and recognition of authenticity by God as the highest thing you could possibly have, high priest, but it was available to the lowest of persons among us. There's no arrogance here. No arrogance. Anybody could have that. And the good news is you didn't have to do that but like 6 weeks. It was a little like Lent. At the end, you know, you had to cut off your hair, you burn it, yeah, get a couple of doves and you're done, you know. And then you can go eat raisins, grapes, and do the wine thing. But it wasn't just a wine thing because you couldn't eat anything that was the fruit of the vine. You couldn't have raisins. So those of you like cinnamon rolls with raisins out, you can't go there. That's part of the reason I've never aspired to, you know, the Nazarite vow. You know, but raisins, grapes, you know, those kinds of things. Nothing that was the fruit of the vine. And it was all symbolic. It had nothing to do with, you know, hygiene or, you know, dietary things or things of this type. So, but it was available to everybody. This is that anti-arrogance thing. Anybody could go there and get to know God that closely. And that was actually, by the way, the only time you could actually offer a sacrifice. Remember, sacrifices were offered by the priest. You didn't go inside the temple. You didn't do anything. Nobody offered sacrifice. God killed a king for offering a sacrifice in the temple. He said, that's not your job. You're supposed to be a shepherd out there helping those folk, not usurping the job of somebody else. But the little Nazarite folk, they actually offered a sacrifice. So he let all of us. I love the phrase somebody mentioned, and I use it all the time, that God always puts the cookies on the bottom shelf. We can get to, you know, that's his heart. All right, so the temple of your holiness, the temple of your distinction, and in your reverence or in your fear, which was that awesomeness. It wasn't like I'm scared to death of God. I don't want to go to temple. Not that kind of fear. It's that reverence that when you went in, you had both both things in God. Too often we can err. Mostly we err on the judgment side of God. God's so awesome. He doesn't listen to my old prayer. You know, I'm just this little dude. You know, it's so big and judgy. You know, and then the other areas, they're so casual. I mean, the big man in the sky. You know, all these kind of little metaphors, this rabid, casual thing. And the reality is both. So David can sit here and just whine at God like he's his father and he's a toddler without the slightest fear that God is just going to smack him across the room. You know. And yet there's that incense, that total reverence, because if he wasn't aware of God's power, he wouldn't be whining to him. He would be going trying to fix his own mess. He'd be partnering up with the evil wicked who were ahead, etc. And so there's that element of our relationship that if we complain to God, we can whine all day long as it's in the context of, I love you, Father, and I trust you. And I know you're big. I just don't understand here. I don't know why this thing didn't work. I tried my best here. I don't understand, and I'm upset about it. And I'm angry and I'm a bitter about it. But at the same time, I trust you. I know you're big in God. I respect you. I don't doubt the beauty of your heart. There's no malice in this deal. Why you didn't let it work or why you made it not specifically fail. And so you can have both those because that's the part of a healthy relationship. I don't understand. Help me understand why you said that about me or why you did that with me. I think of to me this thing. So 9. Yahweh, okay, so he says, I'm going to come into your temple. Then he changes on 9. He says, Yahweh, make straight before me your way. And it's just, Yahweh, lead me, that's right, lead me in your righteousness because of the ones that are my enemy. Make straight before me your path. And the make straight before me is both straight and level. And we talked a little bit about that last time. I think this is probably where we got through last time, was that the straight path was where you wanted to walk. Because you were always walking through mountains, and there were always, you know, things on either side of you, and you always had to be able to run at a moment's notice if you're traveling on roads out in the highways, because there were bandits everywhere. It was always a terrifying thing to have to travel when you went out of the town back in those days. There were robbers and bandits. One of the favorite psalms that I misunderstood for the longest time, where it's a, called a Song of Ascents. It said, I will lift up my eyes to the hills, because he's going to go to Jerusalem where the big mountain is, and says, from whence cometh my help? ? And you thought, what does that got to do with going, taking a trip to the mountain, until you learn about the bandits? And said, I'm going to trust you, God, and I'm going to obey you by taking this hazardous journey. And so my help comes from you. So if you don't help me on this journey, I ain't going to make it. My little family ain't going to make it. You know, and that's part of what that, from whence cometh my help? Well, it's going to have to come from God, because there ain't going to be anybody else going to help me on this road to Jerusalem. And so that's a treachery. So you always wanted a path that was clear and level for both your sheep. You didn't want them falling off into the thickets, you know, and yourself. You didn't want to sprain your ankle because you didn't have medical care back in those days. And, you know, you always wanted to be careful with that. So he's asking specifically that God would lead him in the right choices. In other words, the last thing you want when you're under attack by wicked enemies is to go wicked yourself. See, because as long as you're innocent and you're appealing to the Lord, okay, as long as you're there, you're in the safest place there is to be when you're under attack. Right? You're just asking God to sit there and be with you and walk with you and take it. What you don't want, of course, is to where God has to decide what to do with you too. You know, so do I deal with him once we get through with these other wicked, or do I turn around and use these wicked on him, teach him a lesson with him? You know, you don't want to force God into making that trade-off decision. You really don't. And there are a number of cases in the Old Testament where you can see God, you can just see the wheels of his mind trying to make a decision as to how far he goes with it. I mean, the ark. In the story of the ark, nobody's supposed to look in the ark except the very narrow little tribe that's supposed to carry the ark. There's only one little tribe there, a little subfamily of Aaron and all these guys. Nobody's supposed to touch this ark. Nobody's supposed to carry it. And the last thing you're supposed to do is say, boy, I wonder what's in there, and open the little tabernacle door and peek in there. Man, you know, that's really bad. And you're supposed to carry it on your shoulders. It's supposed to be Levites that carry it. And they got little poles for it and all this kinds of stuff, right? Well, the Israelites decide that they're going to fight the Philistines. And they figure, well, we'll use the magic approach. So we'll put the ark, we'll take our holy relic. You know, we won't pray about this and trust the Lord. We'll just try to manipulate him and figure he'll try to defend his own ark. So we'll put it in front of the battle. We'll go out to this fight, you know. And you can see God say, no, what should I do with this one? I mean, you know, I really don't want them to lose the ark, you know. But I don't want them to teach them that they, you know, I'm a Coke machine. They put 50 cents in, they always get a Coke, and so that's what they use the ark for, you know, and all this kinds of machines. And so he makes this trade-off decision, and he decides, in this case, I'm going to let the ark go into captivity. So the Philistines win the war. They take the ark, and then God judges all the Philistines, you know, for mistreating the ark and all that. It's a separate problem. But then the Philistines, they learn their lesson. Even they learn. They said, hey, this ark is where God goes. We're going to get rid of this. This thing is doing all these tumors and all kinds of problems that we're having biologically in our thing. So let's give this back to the Israelites. So they put the ark on a cart, and they put some cows up there, and the cows are going to haul it off, and the little pagan priests say, well, if it goes this way, we'll know that this was all accident. You know, this was just a freak of nature that we got all these diseases at the same time we had the ark. But if it just goes by itself up to the Israelites, then we'll know that it was the hand of the Lord. Well, it goes straight up there. They don't even stop, and all this kind of stuff. Well, the Israelites are overjoyed, right? They're overjoyed because the ark has come back. So they go get the ark, and instead of following instructions, you know, they carry the ark themselves by hand. They don't use Levites. They violate every law that they're supposed to do. But they carry it like 26 miles and nothing goes wrong. And you can see God trying to make a decision here. It's, what do I do here again? You know, I want them to be excited about this and stuff like this. But, and then one of the guys says, well, you know, since this is working so far, I'm going to open that door. I've always wondered what was in there. And he opens it up in front of everybody. Everybody knows there's actually a Levite there that's supposed to know this. And God strikes him and kills him and a couple of the other folk around, which is what God had promised in the covenant. Said, you do this, this is what happens. Okay? And so God, but you can see him waiting as long as he can and said, you know, if they step over some line, I got to do this. And so he kills them, and so they're scared to touch the ark. You know, they go in the opposite direction. You know, instead of following instructions, they say, we're not going to touch this thing at all. And so then the local Levite comes out and gets it and brings it to his house. And then God blesses him immensely, you know, because he does it the right way. And David was the one who did this. See, David was the one who did it. And David gets upset at God for killing this poor guy, Uzziah. And he names the little town Breach Against, you know, Crime Against Uzziah. Uzziah is what he names the little town. And he goes off and sulks, you know, and David's upset for, you know, 10, 15 years. And then decides that he's going to try one more time and bring it up to Jerusalem. Wants to bring the ark up. Because he sees it. Wasn't apparently that God was upset because he's blessed this guy over here that's got the ark. You know, really tremendously. Obed-Edom, his name was. And so he said, we're going to try this again. And then he says, it was because we didn't do it the way God told us to do it that we got judged. And so he does it the right way this time. And he gets all the little tent poles and the little shoulders and the Levites. And then God blesses it immensely and he brings it to Jerusalem. But you can see, again, that's one of those trade-off decisions. You see God trying to decide, you know, where does he draw the line? Where is, you know, and this is constantly in our lives in terms of the same way, you know, him dealing with us. You know, where do I call it? Okay, so going straight here, Yahweh, lead me in your righteousness because of my enemies there, and lead me in your path. And one of the things he's asking for is that he will make the right choices, okay? Because the enemies are, if he goes down the wrong path, guess where he's going to end up at? In their clutches. And so what he wants is that holy right. He wants the right road to the temple, you know, so he can order his prayer and he can stay there and be in a safe place in the chesed of God. For, and here's another contrast, for not from his mouth, that's the treacherous, is there any trustworthy, is there any reliability in what they say? Their heart is destruction. An open grave is their throat, and their tongue they speak deceit. This is a quote, the New Testament quotes this. St. Paul quotes this about humans, okay, and specifically the Jews of his day. But it's also just about humans, that we all have this element in us at different times of life and in different situations. This will pop up, but this is an important New Testament quote. And his point is that he's treacherous in what he says. You can't depend on it. It's always a little bit of truth, so it's not tricky to it, but you don't know whether it's, how much of it's truth, how much of it is a lie, but it's not reliable, whatever it is. Okay? The heart is destruction, and that's the word for like a destroyed crop. It's just dangerous. A grave, the throat is an open grave. And one of the comments that I've got in the syllabus there is that there were two things about an open grave. An open grave was built for you to fall into it. In other words, it was already there waiting for you to die or hopefully for them to eventuate your death. So the wicked are setting all things up for David's demise. And one commentator said the only other problem about an open grave, they were buried together. Okay? You know, they were family tombs. Even if you were poor, you had a cave or you had a plot, and you were all buried together, and you went through a common opening, and you were buried in, like, shelves. You know, your little coffins were on the shelf. You've seen these in, like, you know, Egyptians and things of this, the catacombs. You know, they were these little things. But you always seal that up because of that famous passage in John, by this time he stinketh. He'd been dead 4 days. Well, an open grave, a throat as an open grave, it's got very, very bad breath. In other words, not only is it a trap trying to trip everybody, but it's foul. It's foul. It's a stench. What it says, it pollutes the community. It spreads out stuff that's bad. You know, it demoralizes. It destroys. It's an open grave. And their throat, and the throat of them, they speak deceit. In other words, they're constantly using their tongues, their abilities to speak, to manipulate, to destroy, to rally support against David, to go kill David and take his throne. You know, so there's almost nothing that's attached to the tongue in the Old Testament that's not also attached to blood somewhere. And that's because when you did deceit in these days, it was literally to kill somebody and or to take everything they had, which would eventuate in their death as well. So, I mean, that's what the tongue, that's what deceit was about. It was to get something that wasn't yours, and at the felony level as opposed to misdemeanor, it was to get enough that it was going to damage them and therefore damage the community. Now, you would be wealthier, but you're not the kind of person that's going to share that with anybody, remember? And so the community doesn't prosper by you getting the money. Prospers when somebody non-arrogant has those resources, has that money, because they'll share it in time of need. They'll leverage, they'll work their land, they'll invest, they'll produce profit for the community and things of this type. Okay, because of the want, 11. Now we get to, what time is it, Mo?
It's 5 minutes after 9.
Okay. Now we get to a category that maybe we'll get to here. 11. Declare them guilty, O Elohim. There's that Elohim word. He's appealing to the moral judge, and they're already guilty. Remember, they're already wicked, they're treacherous, they're men of bloodshed, and they're already guilty. You know, God just hasn't judged them yet. And like in the Psalm 4, he said to them, he said, you guys are guilty and wicked, go clean up your act first and then offer righteous sacrifices, and then I won't have to pray for God to judge you. And we are now in another level here where they're already in the damage mode. They're already bloodshed. They're at a much more serious letter. These words are much stronger than in Psalm 4. And David takes that next step and he says, declare them guilty, O God. Let them fall by their intrigues, for many are their sins. Okay, fall by their intrigues. Now, fall by their intrigues is let them basically reap what they sow. So, in Scripture, one of the ways God judged evil was, the classic example is they dug a pit for the innocent as a trap, and they fell into it themselves and couldn't get out. That's the normal way God likes to judge things in Israel history. Instead of intervening with, you know, police force, basically, or judges, you know, what you reap, you sow. You make you intend some harm, it falls back, it ricochets. You set up the thing to fall on them, it falls on you, just as you were trying to run away and set it up. It's the coyote, you know, over against the roadrunner. Every time he sets up some kind of trap, it always falls on him. He's so wicked in the Old Testament sense of the word, you know. And obviously that's a profiling problem, but that's a separate issue. He's not praying, actually, for anything other than what the law has already said. The law says you get what you get what you plan to do to somebody else. Actually, in the Old Testament law, remember the old eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth? And we normally think that that's like a bad thing. It's caricatured in Western civilization as being, you know, vengeance or bloodthirsty. It actually was a cap on crimes, because in the other nations around the world, it was like a body for an eye. And it was so much, there were no caps on the legal penalties to keep you from being abusive in the violence that you did against an evil person. So that it was more of a mercy to say, just an eye for an eye, basically, is what they're saying. Just a tooth for a tooth. No more than that. You know, you'd only do punishment, you know, in regard to crime. No more, nothing beyond this. Okay, it was more of a merciful cap, and it didn't literally mean actually gouge out an eye. It was a principle. Sometimes you could pay for somebody, if you had damaged somebody's ox, you could buy them another ox, you know. Wouldn't have to be you gave up one of your oxen or killed one of your oxen or something of that type. So, but in this, one of the rules that they had is that if somebody intended to do evil, a violent crime against somebody, and they were caught, and had already bragged that this was their intent. It was clear that that's what they intended. The law said you do to them what they intended to do to somebody else. In other words, it was that strong of a don't go there because it's going to come back on your head. Be sure your sin will find you out. And it's like a ravenous wolf, you know, like a panther that comes back and sniffs you out and returns and attacks you. And so what David is actually playing here, he says, hey, look, they're guilty. You know they're guilty, and it's time now to declare them guilty and let them fall into their own trap. They had set this trap by their own machines that they had done, the evil that they were doing, by the gallows that they were going to hang Mordecai on. Hang them. Okay? That kind of model. You know, and he's just praying that they will get what God had already promised to do for them. God let them fall by their intrigues, for many are the sins. Banish them, for they rebelled against you. Now, there were two things. When somebody in the community, remember, everybody lived in villages. Nobody lived in the country because it was very dangerous to live in the country. You had no defenses against marauding bands. Those nomads, the Amalekites, the Moabites that would come through and just capture you and your family and sell you into slavery for money. You know, they'd take your crop, and what they couldn't take, they'd burn down, they'd take you and sell you into slavery. You know, you needed strength in numbers. You needed safety in numbers, and that's why everybody's in villages. Okay? Everybody lives in a village. And what you cannot afford in a village is a saboteur. You just can't, it can't work. You can't have somebody in the village whose purpose is a terrorist to destroy the village, right? You just can't allow a saboteur to exist when your life depends upon the community, see? And they don't have prisons in these days, period. There's no such thing as that in the little villages. You either do one of two things if they're not going to change and they won't move away. You either kill them or you banish them. That's your only choice. You hope that you can, you know, convert them when they're kids, but if they come in and they've grown to be an adult and they're, you know, they're stuck in their ways and they like it and they see nothing wrong with it and blah, 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 you don't have a choice. You know, you either kill them or you banish them. Banishing is slightly more merciful, but less secure because they know your village. They know your people. They know the weak spots. It's a bad thing to banish somebody that hates you unless you can banish them very, very far away. Right? And so that's a mercy in itself, just to pray for banishment to these people. Let them fall in their own trap. Let them be ostracized by the community. Let them be driven away. For they rebelled against you, and that rebellion is that active word against Elohim. It's not just that they had evil thoughts and they were upset about people and they were, you know, they just didn't participate and they didn't come to the club meeting. You know, these people are out there, you know, at night stealing things, you know, moving the landmarks over by 4 feet into their, you know, into your land, taking your crop and the brook. The brook was on my side of the fence just yesterday. No, but they're powerful people and they can argue in court and they got smoother tongues than you do. And they can say, no, it's always been there. Look over here. Look at this little evidence here. They could always talk their way into something because they were powerful and their throats were open graves, etc. Okay? So, this is a judgment thing that David is now praying for judgment. Okay, now we have to switch and we go now to page 41. And we cover a very tough area called imprecatory psalms. This will trip you up a lot. And it will trip you up even when you know how to deal with this stuff. Imprecatory psalms are basically where you pray for God to judge somebody, an enemy. You call, and remember that's called a curse. Yeah, page 41. Do you have that? Anybody got a page 41?
No.
Okay.
I thought I gave you one.
Okay, page 41 handouts. All right. Here we go. And the imprecatory prayers or psalms or whatever are where you pray for God to judge somebody. Just like David did, declare them guilty, oh God, let them fall in their own traps. Okay? And the problem, and sometimes they're even stronger than that. We'll see a couple in this passage here, in this handout, that are even stronger than this. I mean, they sound really bad. And the problem comes when we try to put that together with Jesus is and Paul's words to love your enemy, bless those that persecute you, pray for those that mistreat you. Do not curse your enemies, basically. I mean, there's a New Testament injunction that seemed to be in just direct opposition to what David does here and does a couple of times in that. So I have a 4-page handout for us to go through on the imprecatory psalm so that you understand exactly the principle. I want to make sure I get through the first two tonight before we close. So there's the introduction, and we're going to read through all this and I'll make comments. The first one is, the imprecatory prayers and prayers for vengeance in the Old Testament are often discussed in terms of the apparent antithesis, opposition, that exists between them and the New Testament commands to love rather than curse one's enemies. And he gives up a whole bunch of verses there. This theological problem is particularly striking when the curses of the New Testament are brought into the picture. Paul, for example, pronounces a curse. You can see a couple of those are in the Gospel, some are in Acts, some are in this, where an actual curse is pronounced on somebody like Satan or something of this type. So even though Paul will say, don't curse your enemies and bless your enemies and pray for them, he will still look like he's contradicting himself in some kind of behavior in some of these other prayers or something of this type. And certainly the Psalms and passages in some of the prophets look like this. So that's the problem with imprecatory psalm. How do we reconcile this call for God to judge somebody, which seems opposite of what Jesus in the New Testament taught, per se? And so I've got a bunch of principles here that we go through. The first one is that when you encounter a situation like that, the first thing you do is you lead with blessing. You don't lead with cursing. You don't start with cursing. Remember our character of God, that he led with patience instead of judgment? He waits. He tries to be good. He tries to good to them and good through their hearts to where they get good eyes, so to speak, through this. He tries to overcome evil with good. Eventually, of course, he's going to have a final judgment. So it doesn't go on forever. And the question is, where do you cross a line between the time that you have to do judgment and that you don't? So the first principle is that you lead with blessing. You always start there. You start with blessing. If you have any opportunity, option, you start with blessing. And here's a particularly difficult passage, but you'll see exactly how this lived out. This is Jeremiah. He's one of the most abused prophets that we know of. Give heed to me, O Lord, and listen to what my adversaries say. Is evil a recompense for good? Yet they have dug a pit for my life. Remember how I stood before you to speak good for them and to turn away your wrath for them. Therefore give their children over to famine. Hurl them out to the power of the sword. Let their wives become childless and widowed. May their men meet death by pestilence. Their youths be slain by the sword in battle. May a cry be heard from their houses when you bring the marauder suddenly upon them. For they have dug a pit to catch me and laid snares for my feet. Yet you, O Lord, know all their plotting to kill me. Do not forgive their iniquity. Do not blot out their sin from your sight. Let them be tripped up before you. Deal with them while you are angry. Okay? Now, let's read the quote there, I guess. The confession itself is almost entirely a prayer for judgment on his enemies. The good which he has done them, verse 20, is to have told the truth and prayed for them. This is where you're supposed to pray for your enemies, Jesus said very explicitly. Okay, pray for them, told the truth, love them. The central part of the prayer, 21:22, might be read as Jeremiah's resignation. This is what they have chosen. Now it must come, awful though it be. If the motive in 23 is blameworthy, the sentiment is still in line with God's declared purpose and the prohibition of the prophet's prayer for the people. Okay, now the background of this, remember, this is the Israel of the exile. Israel is about to go in exile. Israel has resisted several centuries of prophets. They have gotten worse and worse. They are selling their own people into slavery. They are doing the child sacrifice. They are doing all the bad things that we talked about earlier. They are persecuting everybody that's good. The priests are extorting money from the people. The prophets are being bribed against what Jeremiah has told them. Jeremiah has told them the Babylonians are outside the gate. If you give yourself, if you submit to the will of God, which is this exile, and go out there, you get your life spared, you get some of your belongings, and you'll be happy. If you don't, if you resist the Word of God, continue to do this, and continue not only resisting the Word of God, but killing everybody who tries to warn you like me, then you are going to get what the Babylonians give every other conquered nation. These things in this list. They're going to come in here, they're going to kill you, they're going to kill all your men, basically your men warriors that fight, and everybody's going to be widowed and childless. You're going to get exactly what I told you, and what the covenant said you were going to get if you persist in this and doing violence and shedding blood in the city. They've had centuries of actually shedding innocent blood inside the city of Jerusalem long before this day. They have not responded, and Jeremiah says, okay, I guess it all comes due today. I have tried, I have prayed for you, and asked God not to do the judging, and yet we've got to this point now, the walls are about to be broken in, and I got to let go. I got to let go. And at one point, God had told Jeremiah, stop praying for Israel. Because what, and that was more for show than anything else, because Jeremiah would go out and pray in public for Israel. See, I mean, he would go out, the prophet was a public life. You couldn't pray in secret as a prophet. You went out in the marketplace, and you prayed that God would spare them from the destruction of the Babylonians through the wall, that they would respond. And you prayed day after day after day, and hopefully that somebody would get the message and they would learn, and some people did, and they were spared all of this. But it's the way some people respond to truth. And this is part of how God does has to deal with truth in a strange way, is that sometimes more truth will make me worse. If we resist light, we harden our heart toward it. And we get harder. And so then if more truth comes in, we're predisposed to reject that, and we get harder and harder. It gets harder to teach us. Harder to learn. We make our hearts dull, to use the prophets. We harden our hearts. We make our hearts stone so that we can't respond anymore. And God has a cure for this in our lives. I mean, we can always go to Him and say, hey, I have a heart of stone. I've noticed it today. I'm cold. I'm hard. I'm dead in my life. I can't believe I said this. I respond this way. I need some help here. I don't like that. That's that reluctant sinner thing. Okay? And so, but then one day God told Jeremiah, don't pray for these people anymore. Go out there and you speak to them. But when it comes to that part of the sermon where you're supposed to pray for the people, say, I'm sorry, God told me I can't pray for you anymore. None of you responding. And that's like the teacher. And it's sort of a little bit like the teacher that tells the students, none of you are going to work hard enough for this grade. There's no sense even studying. Don't even mess with this. Test too hard for you guys. You can't do this. You know, you'll never pass this. You don't have the incentive or the morale. It's like coaches would do to the coach language. Oh, you guys are a bunch of whips. We're in the fourth quarter. Blah, blah, blah. You ain't got it in you. Forget it. Why don't you I remember one coach saying, why don't you just put on your dresses and go home? just trying to shame you and guilt you into this thing, you know. And it was this kind of model to where it's just, I can't pray for you because you're not responding anymore. God said not to do it. And so that's a little wake-up call itself to these people. But the point was, you lead with blessing. You don't start there, ever. You start with the heart of God staying on, reporting all day long, I have held my hands to a rebellious and stubborn-hearted people. And I told you, open your mouth wide and I will fill it. And you would not. I got these cisterns of living water. And instead of coming and drinking freely from it, you go and dig your own wells with nothing in them but dust. You know, nobody's thinking here. Next verse. In fact, in some of these very psalms, of course, precatory psalms, where he prays for God to vindicate his own honor and name, David protests that he has kind thoughts toward these same evildoers. This is Psalm 35, 12, 14. David mourns, they repay me evil for good and leave my soul forlorn. Yet when they were sick, I put on sackcloth and humble myself with fasting. When my prayers returned to me unanswered, when you didn't answer my prayer for their healings, I went about mourning as though for my friend or brother. I bowed my head in grief as though weeping for my mother. This is that leading for blood. And this is what Jeremiah did. Jeremiah is called the weeping prophet. You know, he weeps up until the day of judgment, and then he says, okay, here it is. They get what they got coming, plus what did to me. And then when the judgment's over, he turns into the weeping prophet again. He writes the book of Lamentations. which is all one big cry of pain over the fallen Jerusalem, all the people, all the widows, the childless, etc. And so you always lead with blessing, and that's where you start. The second principle is be willing to imprecate yourself. This is about evil, not favoritism. And this is Psalm 7, which we'll get to. Oh Lord my God, if I have done this, if there is wrong in my hands, if I have repaid my ally with harm or plundered my foe without cause, then let the enemy pursue and overtake me, trample my life to the ground and lay my soul in the dust. See, that's imprecatory prayer. He's praying for God to judge him if he's done this evil. There's no favoritism here. If you're treacherous like these people are David, and David says, hey, look, I'm asking for you to help against these people that have done this to me, but let me be clear. If it's me here that's the root cause, if I'm the one that's done it, then judge me. I'm not asking for you to love the wicked and punish the other wicked. Okay, so you lead with blessing, and you understand that this is not about them versus us. This is about the treacherous versus the non-treacherous. And you have to keep if you're treacherous, you have to be willing to take the responsibility. If you fall in if you dig a pit, you need to, the honest man says, let me fall in it if I dig it, Lord. Help me learn from my mistakes. Let me reap what I sow. You know, go merciful, but I want this. And so imprecation is that call for justice. If I have done it, I'm not immune from it. And so you have to go there. Then, so David invoked death by his enemy's hand. This was the opposite of sort of what he's wanting, if he were guilty as they charge. If that last quote at the bottom of that page. If he had done such a thing, the psalmist swears, then let certain terrible things happen to him. The words are addressed to God and in effect cancel the earlier prayer for deliverance only if the psalmist is indeed guilty of the charges against him. See, earlier in that psalm, which we'll see later, he's already prayed for God to deliver him from the enemies. And right here he says, but if I am the enemy, then cancel deliverance and bring judgment on me because I deserve it. I want moral justice from Elohim. I want you to act in our community and fix this very bad thing. The first penalty which the psalmist invites in the case of his guilt is the very thing that he feared and that prompted his prayer in the first instance, namely that he be both pursued and overtaken. Now let me mention one thing about this. For David, the worst thing in the world for him is to be pursued. Because he spent all those years running from Saul, hiding in caves, watching his men die on avalanches in the dust, in the caves outside the hills of Judea, constantly wrestling with doubt about God's promise to make him king, and every time Saul got put in his hands, why he didn't kill him, and everybody told him, you go ahead and do justice in the name of God, and he didn't do it, and the constant doubt about this, the thing he hated most was to flee from men. And so when God, later he becomes king, and God he has that sin of the census, where he gets all arrogant, because it's a stupid thing. He does the sin, and God says, okay, take the punishment. Okay, you can either have 3 days of pestilence, 3 days of a disease, or you can have 3 months of running from your enemies. Take your pick. And he says, I don't want to run from enemies ever again. I'll take pestilence. Let me fall into the hand of the Lord and not into the hand of men. Because between those two, if there's somebody that's ever forgiving, it's going to be God, right? So David does not like to run from enemies. He's done that too much in his life. He does it again for Absalom. That's part of that dark night of the soul that he goes through. He goes through it a couple of times. And so the first penalty the psalmist invites in the case of his guilt is the very thing he feared and prompted his prayer, that he be pursued and overtaken. This is big. He says, I'm willing to stand by truth at this point, to this level. The consequence of being overtaken is spelled out in 6, in effect of his death, for his life to be trampled into the earth and his glory to be set down in the dust implies not only the destruction of his body, but it indicates potentially the departure for Sheol or the netherworld, the grave. The psalmist's glory was not merely his personal honor, but his capacity to praise and worship God. If he were guilty, that capacity would go along with life itself. The solemn oath sworn by the psalmist and the accusations laid against him invite arbitration and a judgment concerning innocence and guilt, so that now the psalmist's prayer turns to a petition for the establishment of a court of judgment. So what has happened in Psalm 7 in this thing, in this case, in the imprecation, in the psalm of prayer? He has said, it looks like the enemies have done this against me and they need judging. It could be I'm at fault. If I'm at fault, I need to be judged. In either event, it needs to be thrown into court. It needs to be thrown into court. And no prayers for cursing ever in the Old Testament is a prayer of, Lord, let me do this to my enemy. It never is. It's always, Lord, you judge the enemy. It is never, let me do this. Okay, they never take vengeance in their own hand. And Scripture, Old Testament, New Testament says, give way to the Lord, for vengeance belongs to God. It is God's job as Elohim to go out there and do those things. Now, sometimes God does that to human judges, human Elohim. You know, I mean, He sets up government for that. And Romans 13 teaches that real clearly. But right now, the point of this principle, it was first, you lead with blessing. You don't start with cursing. You lead with blessing. Okay. The second thing is you got to recognize that you may be guilty as they are in some other areas. Clean up your act. Don't presume that you are more righteous than they are in all cases. Maybe just this. And then the next principle, and I think this is probably all we'll get through tonight, where are we time-wise?
9:30.
Okay, let me cover part of this point, because and this is a big one, because this is the practicality point. The principle on top of the page 42, most of the time it is about legitimate means, judgment, to a legitimate relief. Most of the time judgment is not about really, really, really repaying them what they deserve. Most of the time, repaying them for what they deserve is to get them out of the way of the righteous and the community. So most of the time, it's an issue of stewardship. It's almost an issue of governance. It has to do with the fact that they're... actually, I think this is a great one. Here's Jeremiah. Remember, Jeremiah was the one that was praying, you know, don't pray for them after he had wept for them all this time. He waited so long. Like God, this is a great verse from Jeremiah here, 15:15. Lord, you know how I suffer. Take thought of me and take care for me. Pay back for me those who have been persecuting me. And this is the next phrase. Don't be so patient with them that you let them kill me. See, because this is where God goes. This is His default choice, is to be patient. And Jeremiah knows this. He says, look, I've been patient with you, but, you know, only so far can we, you know, before, you know, I go with you this far, be patient with them up to the point where they're going to kill me. And then remember these other issues. I'm a prophet. I'm supposed to be helping other people. If you kill me, I can't help other people. So don't be so patient with them that you let them kill me. Be mindful of how I have put up with their insults for your sake. In other words, he never was vengeful. He put up with their insults for God's sake, for His love for them, the long-suffering. He was patient, but He was getting scared here toward the end and said, look, I know you go on this side, but this is a practical matter. I still have people to minister to, so I need to ask for your intervention here and judge them in this case. God had promised ultimately to deliver and vindicate Jeremiah. So He knew that was going to happen in the future. But in light of the coming calamity, Jeremiah asked for a speedy settling of accounts. He wanted God to avenge him on his persecutors. Though God was long-suffering, Jeremiah hoped for swift justice. He wanted to be vindicated before God would take him away in death. Now remember, he had already said, you know, I've been good to these people. I have tried to minister to these people. So he is led with blessing. Okay, and there are a couple of places in there where Jeremiah is rebuked by God for some inappropriate attitudes in his life. Separate thing. And same thing for Baruch. He gets rebuked one time. Basically the thing was there, this is a legitimate means. Judgment here was for a legitimate end, for relief. Relief from treachery, relief from destroy. This is not actually relief from just bad rumors. You know, these are people killing him and killing his ability to help other people escape the judgment of Babylon. So more than is at stake than just little Jeremiah. See, this is what God is trying to do. These guys are in the way. The second of this pair of laments begins with a cry for revenge on his enemies. The cry for revenge begins with a familiar phrase from a protestation of innocence, O Lord, thou knowest. The enigmatic third colon, in your forbearance, do not take me away, probably means do not be so patient with my enemies that they have time to destroy me. Okay? Actually, we can read the last two and then we'll close in prayer. See, O Lord, how distressed I am. This is Lamentation. This is still Jeremiah. Again, this is after the fall now. See, O Lord, how distressed I am. I am in torment within, and in my heart I am disturbed for. And I have been, for I have been most rebellious. Okay? Outside the sword bereaves, inside there is only death. People have heard my groaning, but there is no one to comfort me. All my enemies have heard of my distress. They rejoice at what you have done. May you bring the day you have announced so that they may become like me. He's actually taking the part of Jerusalem. When Jerusalem fell, Edom, a bunch of the nations around it were just sitting there applauding. Because as soon as they hated the Jews, and as soon as the Jews were going to be carried away, guess what they were going to do with all their property and all their land and all their crops? They were just tickled to death at somebody else's misfortune. Tickled to death. God doesn't like that either. He doesn't like judging His people, but He really hates it when other people gloat over that. And that says, and He prays it precatorily, they rejoice at what You have done, God. You judged us. Okay? Now, make them like me. In other words, if I'm going to get judged for my sins, for my obvious crimes, for that kind of attitude, make it equal here. Don't show any favoritism to them. Judge them in the same way. Deal with them as you have dealt with me because of all my sins, my groans. The last verses admit that the Lord was right in His judgment, yet turned quickly to an appeal to Him because the city's wretchedness was so severe. There was disillusionment, too, with the falseness of other nations as friends and as a source for help. There's a terrible recognition of the truth of sin and punishment here and of the reality of the power of God alone. Again, there was no one to comfort, only God. And no mere ally could do this. And it was not yet time for him to do so. The poem ends with a plea that Judah should not endure God's wrath alone, but that her enemies, too, should be brought to account in the day of their wrath. And I don't mention this here, but when God judged Israel, He had already told them, at the end of this process of exile, I will call you back. You'll get a new heart, you'll learn, and I'll call you back. And I have not found a single nation that He judged, like these Moabs and Edomites, Edomites and things of this type, that He's going to judge right here under this judgment, that God doesn't say that I'm going to restore their fortunes as well. In other words, it's all sort of teaching. It's pedagogy. It has this, it's a very severe character to it. And if it's this bad, and it hurts, and it's okay to call it down because sometimes we're not going to learn. Now, it's that old thing, God talks to us quietly and tells us what to do. And if we don't listen, He'll speak a little louder. Especially if it's about stuff that's hurting other people. And He'll keep talking a little louder and a little louder until finally He'll get our attention. And for Israel, they had to get attention this way. Moab was going to get it the same way. But the end game was still restoration. I want you guys to dwell together in peace and harmony. I want everybody to pull together and work together. So the first 3 points, and we'll cover the rest of them, was you lead with blessing. That's what Jesus and Paul said. You start there. Okay. The second thing is you recognize that you're subject to it as well. That's entirely legitimate. You can't at the same time call somebody to be judged for an enemy and expect to escape it when you call it too. When you ask God to be Elohim and intervene into a thing and you're part of that equation, rest assured that you don't escape on that basis. And the third thing, like I say, it's largely a practical matter. You only ask God to judge when it's so destructive that you need to banish or kill them or remove their ability to do damage to other people. It's now a judgment call. They've stepped over that line, and now it's not just a personal insult issue or something that you could bear with long suffering. They're actually destroying other things. You were allowed in the Old Testament law to defend your home against an attacker. You don't just pray for them and let them run over and steal everything off. If you killed the thief in the daylight hour when you had an opportunity just to wound him and call friends, then you were liable. But you were still allowed to respond with a police action or force action in cases of legitimate assault. If it was just an insult, you're back into Psalm 4. You can't do this. If it's just an insult, you may have to bear with it. But if it starts getting dangerous, and it starts taking people apart and dividing the community and things that are going to actually end up hurting everybody, then you may have to ask God, say, I need some intervention here. judge. Me too. I don't want to be exempt. There's no unfairness with this. And so we'll work through this some more when we get back together again.